Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
There is a place that is spoken about only in whispers. A dark area that spawns the beginnings of urban legends. A place where anything can happen and usually does. During the light of day, it hides just outside of view. But when the sun goes down, spirits, creatures of the night, roam free, and things do go bump in the night. It is in every state and every country, and there is no escaping it, no matter how safe you feel behind your locked doors and latched windows. So we invite you to turn down the lights and turn up your radio while we join Dave Schrader and Tim Dennis, your hosts, on a journey into the darkness on the edge of town.
Good evening and welcome. You're tuned in to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. We've got a great show lined up for you tonight. The Ghost Studies. Brandon Masullo, our guest. New perspectives on the origins of paranormal experiences. And as we continue to do this show, I'm always interested in new perspectives, new ideas, looking at the origins of the paranormal experience, how some people will experience the paranormal and others will not. Sometimes people that claim to be sensitives will not have any activity in a well-known haunted place, but yet somebody who thinks they're as psychic as a doorknob keep getting pestered, keep hearing things, seeing things. How does this work? Why does this work? Well, our guest is here to chat with that about that tonight. Brandon Masullo is a clinical therapist and a parapsychologist residing in Medina, Ohio, fascinated by paranormal phenomena for more than 20 years. He's been a participant in and featured speaker at numerous paranormal forums and events. He studied psychology and parapsychology at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland. His research has been cited in numerous parapsychological journals, articles, and mainstream books. His new book, The Ghost Studies, New Perspectives on the Origins of Paranormal Experiences. Thank you for joining us tonight, Brandon.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it, Dave.
Is it Medina or Medina?
Medina. You got it exactly right.
I grew up in Medina, Illinois. With the H, we're ritzy over there. We added an extra letter at the end, but I know there's another town spelled the same way yours is, but they refer to it as Medina. So I wasn't sure which way we're going.
Yeah, that's what my GPS calls it, Medina.
let's chat a little bit about your background as a therapist. What made you decide to start to investigate parapsychology?
Well, I've actually always been interested in parapsychology. Well, I shouldn't say always. Since high school, that's really when I started reading some books about it, got really interested in it. And then I went to college with an undergrad degree in psychology. And it's, you know, an undergrad degree, you kind of have an interest in parapsychology. But to be honest, there's not a lot of money in it. And
no. Really?
None.
Come on. You mean Venkman and Stance lied to us? There's not big bucks in ghost hunting?
Well, they had to take out a pretty big loan to get
they did. Yeah.
But so I started doing psychology, and then there's no places in America that really have any universities that actually teach parapsychology. So I kind of went the conservative route. I got the undergrad in psychology. Then I got my graduate degree in counseling. And I, you know, worked in the clinical setting for probably about 6-7 years. And then I just said, you know what? I'm going to go for it. So I applied and got accepted to the University of Edinburgh in Scotland. And I actually studied psychological research methods. But my specialization was in parapsychology. And I studied under Dr. Caroline Watt at the Koestler Parapsychology Unit. And that's where I learned the most about parapsychology. You know, you read these books for 10, 15 years and you think you have a grasp on it. But when you're actually thrown in it and you're actually doing research, you really learn on the fly. And that's, for me, that's the best way to learn.
Well, talk to me a little bit about this, the study of parapsychology. Because as you said, you had to go to Edinburgh to study this.
Yeah.
Why do you think it's not a recognized science or theorem here in the United States?
You know, I've often thought about that, and I really can't come up with an answer for that. You know, there's a ton of interest in parapsychology. You know, you put a parapsychology course in a college, I think you're going to pack it. You know, maybe that there's not a lot of, you know, research in parapsychology maybe could be looked down upon by mainstream psychology. So I think probably in the next 10 years, you're probably going to see some colleges start to pick up parapsychology. But over in the UK, it's not that uncommon. You know, when I lived in Edinburgh, I you know, you couldn't go into a shop down there, and everywhere you went, they told you a ghost story, and it was very open, and they loved parapsychology. It was a huge part of the whole atmosphere in Edinburgh.
It is kind of ridiculous, right? Because you can go take Theorem of Rock and Roll Music. You can take classes in the United States on Game of Thrones.
Yeah, I took a philosophy class in my undergrad. It was just on The Matrix, the movie, you know.
See, I could be teaching those. It sounds like stoners are running the colleges nowadays.
That's right.
Yeah, today we're going to talk about the Theorem of Rush, dude. This band rocks. That's crazy. Well, all right. Now, is this parapsychology, when you sign up to be a parapsychologist and go to a school that teaches this, do you find that what it is it's a trendy term attached to an actual psychological study that, you know, okay, let's make it tie into ghosts, which is what a lot of these classes do when they're doing history. They turn them into stories about the Vikings or the stories about Game of Thrones in a way to, you know, spoon feed people information with a little bit of sugar in every bite. When you go in for parapsychology studies, kind of walk the layman that's never had this experience through. What is that like to go to classes for that? And how do they start the class, I should say?
Well, what they really do is they give you a strong foundation in sort of psychological research methods. So you really learn how to conduct the study, the appropriate ways to do it. You know, you learn a lot about statistics, you know, t-tests, how to run statistical programs, you know, validity. So you really spend a majority of the time learning what research is and the appropriate way to do it, scientific methods, hypotheses. So that's really what the base is. And then once you – so the base is a majority of it. And then once you sort of are familiar with the base – Then you actually start taking some courses which are have a parapsychology topic related to them. So they kind of more focus on the research than they do the parapsychology. So you know, I think I maybe got 3 or 4 classes which were actually dealt with parapsychology. But then my research dissertation was a huge research project or an experiment in a parapsychological topic.
All right. And they're studying this. They're teaching this. They're obviously taking it seriously. But do they take it seriously in the way that let's learn about parapsychology and the study of the paranormal so that we can disprove that it exists? Or are they doing it in an open-minded forum where you go in to learn the study, the practice, the principles of the theorem, and then try to put it to practical application? Can we then prove or disprove that this phenomena exists?
I think at least the parapsychologists I met were pretty open-minded. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I know that, you know, there are some out there that are pretty lean towards the skeptic side of things. And then there's a lot that are leaning towards the believing side of things. And you really see a divide sometimes in parapsychology. Now, you know, there's you know, what are you? Do you believe or do you not believe? So it's like, you have to choose a side. But you know, for the most part, I think a lot of parapsychologists are open-minded. If you go either way, then, you know, that confirmation bias, and that can affect your research.
All right. I want to know a little bit about your background going into this. Did you have a belief in ghosts, UFOs, psychic ability, telekinesis, or was this just, you know, at that point, just fun imaginings?
Yeah, I was a pretty ardent skeptic for the most part, even when I was studying parapsychology. So I didn't really have a belief in it. I never had a paranormal experience growing up. You know, a lot of times people who get into this field or even paranormal investigations and those types of things have these encounters, these amazing encounters when they're younger, living in haunted houses, whatever the story is. I never had that. I only had my books. And, you know, so I was a pretty ardent skeptic. And, you know, I would read the skeptic blogs. A lot of the research I read mainstream-wise sort of leaned towards that way. It was only after I really started opening my mind to these sort of alternative thoughts, which is, you know, Rupert Sheldrake, Carl Jung, Nandor Fodor. These types of things sort of opened my eyes to other possibilities. And that's really where I'm at now.
All right. So you started as a skeptic. Where would you put yourself on the spectrum at this point in your life of believer or skeptic?
I definitely think that there's a lot of things out. There's things that science, I mean, science has dropped the ball when it comes to explaining paranormal phenomenon. I mean, that's a fact. So there's things out there that are genuine that we really don't have answers to. So I guess I would.
All right. Well, let's start there real quickly then before we get too deeply involved. What do you believe are the facts that they're just overlooking or that they're just not examining, but you believe are real things?
The one thing that I find to be the most fascinating when it comes to the paranormal is, these spontaneous cases. So these are your, you know, your deathbed visions, your crisis apparitions. So these are, when I say spontaneous cases, kind of what I'm talking about is things that happen to people who aren't expecting it, and they only really happen once or twice in their lives. That's the beauty of sometimes these spontaneous case examples. So I think those are the most, to me, they provide the most proof of, you know, paranormal experiences.
I agree with you. Those are interesting because it's not a bunch of weekend warriors going out to a haunted location with a bunch of gadgets and gear, which I'm one of, but it's people that are just living everyday ordinary lives. And yet the supernatural seems to fold into one of these daily adventures, and whether it ever is repeated again or not, it's something that exceeds the realm of normalcy.
Yeah, and I think you can get a wealth of information from these spontaneous cases. You know, there's fewer variables, you know, which make identifying the processes involved, you know, less complicated. And I think that's an important thing to get. You know, if I stay a night in a haunted hotel and I bring my EMF, there's some sort of suggestibility that the place is haunted and I might have an experience. But if I'm just laying in bed, you know, minding my own business on a random Tuesday night, and in front of me pops, my mother, who, you know, just passed away or something like that. You know, I'm not expecting it. I'm definitely not, you know, my room is not haunted. So this is a great example of something that is pretty genuine.
I agree with you. I get a lot of people that will ask me, are you afraid? And I laugh and I say, afraid of what? Well, are you afraid you're going to run into something? And I tell them, well, are you afraid when you go to the zoo that you're going to see an animal? I put myself in a lot of these positions because I want to see something. Now, like you, though, that's one position. But if I'm at home sitting on the bed, you know, eating Cheetos and watching adult TV in my underwear and the ghost of my mom appears, yeah, it's going to be an unsettling moment for us on this side and on the other side, right?
Yeah, yeah. And a majority of these experiences happen when, you know, people are sort of just zoned out and in a nice, relaxed space and just not thinking about things. These are when these occurrences happen the most.
Now, tell me from the psychological aspect, what would science have us believe that means?
Oh, boy. Well, anytime you're at night in bed, they're going to tell you it has to do with sleep paralysis or waking hallucinations, misinterpretation, waking dreams. Gosh, I can keep going. Reality.
But the number is so insanely high of people that have had crisis moments where they suddenly feel like their mother's passed away. And they pick up the phone and call, and they're crying on the other end, your mom just passed away. Or they get this overwhelming, feel that somebody's in the room with them, maybe a relative or so, and they, then they get the phone call 2 seconds later that relative passed on. I mean, there's those kind of weird moments, and they are overwhelming. At this point, it seems to me, and it sounds like it does to you as well, Brennan, that it's kind of like, how do we just keep dismissing this?
Yeah, it's baffling. It really is, but... You know, we've been dismissing them since the 1800s. I mean, Phantasms of the Living was a book that came out in the late 1800s. It has 600 some cases. I believe it's 600 some cases of spontaneous paranormal case or spontaneous paranormal occurrences or phenomena. You keep going and going and going. Every year there's more of these things and just gets dismissed as misinterpretation, misremembering. I used to be on that side. You know, I used to be over there going, well, that didn't happen.
Right.
It's like telling somebody, hey, that didn't happen. But it did happen. No, it didn't happen. I have a degree, so,
I have a degree. I love that answer. See, that's my problem, Brennan. Nobody believes me because I don't have a degree.
But, it's kind of like, that authoritarian, I've done all the research and you're wrong, but this is a person's experience. You're not going to tell someone, you don't love your mother, because I have a degree, you don't love, it's a weird dynamic. But once I started talking to people and just actually listening to their experiences and not trying to debunk them, you really become more and more fascinated with it. And these people aren't lying. There's no way they're lying. They had an experience. Sometimes it causes distress. Sometimes it causes them to feel wonderful about what the future can be. But it's their experiences that are the most engaging and provide the most proof for me.
What aspect of the study is most fascinating to you?
The study of parapsychology?
Yes. I mean, ghosts, psychic abilities, mediumistic tendencies, sleep paralysis. What does, and maybe that's a good idea too, is what do we define as paranormal in parapsychological circles?
For me, what a lot of my interest falls in is you can call it ghosts. I prefer the term apparitions because ghosts really and spirits denotes survival after death. Apparitions is more just viewing a ghost-like image. So there's kind of a big difference between that. Does seeing an image of your deceased mother automatically mean that you saw a ghost? But my primary research is paranormal apparitions, ghosts, that type of thing. I'm also a big fan of telepathy as well.
Big fan, meaning you like the concept? Or that you believe that the reality exists? Because, listen, I'm a huge fan of invisibility, and it's not real that I'm aware of. What do you mean by telepathy? Do you believe that it does exist?
I think a lot of these experiences, when we talk about crisis apparitions, deathbed apparitions, you're laying in your bed and you see a vision of your mom and she says, I'm leaving. Thanks for everything. And then you get a phone call saying she passed away. I think that those, to me, that's almost a form of telepathy.
I agree. I agree. And letting my nerd light shine brightly, I'll just say this. I've often thought that, if we do have these connections, we all are energetic beings, and we have connections, especially to those that we're closest to through DNA or genetics, right?
Yep.
It would only make sense that in those moments, as the energy is going out, that much like the holographic image, pushed out of R2-D2 with Princess Leia, at that moment, our brain may receive that message and kind of play it. And although it may not physically be in the room, it may be something that the lenses of our perception of our eyes or our third eye might be picking up on.
Yeah, exactly. It's almost like, you know, a telepathic distress signal your mom sent you and you picked up on. And you mentioned being linked. So a lot of these occurrences happen between people who are linked, and that's usually through family or strong emotional connection. So that's that resonance that Rupert Sheldrake talks a lot about when he talks about telepathy. There's sort of like this connection we have with certain people. We're, if you want to say, we're on the same frequency with them. So if there is a distress signal sent, much like a radio signal, it's going to go to a certain frequency. So
Brandon Masullo is our guest, and in the book, you kind of discuss that there are some new and exciting scientific theories that may explain things like apparitions. We just started to touch on that, hauntings and communications from the dead. Where are these exciting new theories coming from? Are they really new, or are they just now being more readily accepted?
I would say they're new. I think they're things that I sort of developed in writing this book. I take a lot of the past research and I sort of give it a little bit of my twist. So, you know, we talk about telepathy. I'm a strong believer in the psi hypothesis when it comes to ghostly encounters. So that's sort of the base of my theory.
Well, what is the psi hypothesis? Please explain that to us.
Oh, sure. I mean, the psi hypothesis. So psi is basically an encompassing term in parapsychology. Psi describes numerous types of paranormal phenomenon like clairvoyance, psychokinesis, remote viewing, telepathy, out-of-body experiences, and ESP. So the general idea when it comes to psi hypothesis is that there's, we'll call it person A, who is the agent or the sender. So this person A sends a telepathic message, usually during a very distressing events such as a life-threatening event, an emotional crisis, an injury, which is sort of picked up by person B, which is the receiver. And this message can be interpreted as a hallucination. I shouldn't say hallucination, but it can be interpreted as audio, visual, tactile, or just that emotional impression or feeling. So what the psi hypothesis really contends is that ghosts are not so much discarnate beings, but rather the workings of psi or ESP, telepathy, thought transference, or sort of communication at a distance between living or recently deceased people. You know, when it comes to theories on ghosts, you really look at two things. There's the spiritualistic theories, which is unfinished business, place or imprint theory. These are the theories that says that this is based, supernatural is real, it's happening. And you have the naturalistic theories, which is mental illness, misinterpretation, sleep paralysis, which means it's more of a natural, there's an explainable reason for it. So the psi hypothesis would fall under that spiritualistic theory. And my thoughts sort of fall under the category of the psi hypothesis. So you have this, you know, when we think telepathy, we don't think ghosts, but there's a lot of overlap between the two. The experiences are pretty similar, actually.
Well, and that would start to make sense of why you and I may be standing in the same room and I'm seeing the holographic image of Princess Leia and you are not, right? Mm-hmm. Is that if it's more of a telepathic mm-hmm. imagery? But then how do we explain, how do I want to place this? All right. I know what it is to see something in my mind's eye. All right. I can differentiate between seeing a form physically in front of me or ethereally in front of me and something that I can vividly imagine in my mind. But if it's truly a kind of an internal projection, how is it that our eyes are interpreting the information from our brain? Are we that easily tricked by our brain that we can create an image that only our eyes will see?
I don't know how to answer that. I don't know if I know the answer to that. I think that,
well, then good day, sir. I said good day.
I think that,
how dare you not have every answer to all of these magical questions we've been searching for eternity.
I think it's a great question. I think that
you're very diplomatic. I like this.
what happens is if we say this, let's call it a telepathic distress signal, right? So it goes from person A to person B. When person B gets it, it's sort of interpreted unconsciously, and it's going to present itself different for different people. So you might smell your mother's perfume. You might hear your mother's voice. You might feel like your dad is, you know, rubbing your arm like he used to do when you were in high school to make you feel. But, you know, you're going to interpret it a little bit differently, I think.
So can we be close enough, do you believe, hypothetically, Brandon and Dave are best buddies. They've known each other, grown up together. They're great friends. And they're at an appointment, at a meeting somewhere, and Dave finds out his mother's passed away. And suddenly he can smell the overpowering scent of her perfume, but so does Brandon.
Hmm.
Now, does this mean that because of our connection, I'm telepathically receiving and transmitting that same message? Is that a possibility, yeah, especially with those that we're most close to?
Yeah, so you're saying it goes from person A to person B to person C.
Well, to give it a little bit, I always hate referring back to my stories because I don't want to bore my listeners, but when my oldest son was born, he was born at home. He was born with a midwife, and it was a breech birth. And at one point, the midwife said I needed to stand up behind my girlfriend, and literally we were going to use gravity to deliver this baby quickly and efficiently. So I stood with my arms like a goalpost. She stood with her back to my chest, slung her arms over my arms, and she would drop her weight and push. And, you know, I would stoically hold her. And as this was progressing, at one point I began to fall backwards because she had just come out of a major contraction, and I relaxed and she dropped into another major contraction, and I started to fall backwards. And something, you know, again, at the time, I just assumed that it was, you know, Bruce Banner Hulk strength that just saved my gal, myself, and my child. My body reacted with this enormous strength. But in all reality, it did feel very much like a set of hands grabbed me from underneath my armpits.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, my mom asked me after the birth, she said, how did you stand back up? She was a nurse for a hospital that deals with spinal cord injuries. And she said, there's just no way you could do what you just did, holding a pregnant woman giving birth, and stand back up. It looked like somebody helped you up. And I said, it felt like it, too. She said, then she asked me, did you smell anything? I said, Mom, I was holding a pregnant woman. I was smelling a lot of things. And she said, no. Did you smell any, like, perfume? I said, oh, yeah, at one point it was very strong. But, again, we were at a house having this birth, and I thought with all the people there in attendance, somebody might have knocked over a bottle of perfume, or maybe sprayed the bathroom on their way out and it was just wafting its way in. But that smell was shared by many of the people in the room. My mom believed that it was my grandmother's perfume. My aunt, who I went out into the living room a few minutes later to talk to, confronted me with the same line of questioning and said, did you smell grandma's perfume? So it was a shared experience between the three of us, but my grandmother died when I was very little, and I have, of course, no recollection of what her perfume smelled like.
Yeah.
But yet the whole room smelled perfume. So could we, if we are powerful enough to be telepathic and receive messages, it would almost seem to make sense that we could, in fact, play them back and share them with others, especially in a moment of a heightened crisis like that. We're trying to push out a baby that's in crisis. You know, everybody's kind of all of the same mindset to make this happen. You know, I would think those might be the moments that we're most open and adept to receiving those type of messages.
Yeah. You know, and there's I don't know if it's a real thing or not. I know I've read it, but there's a thing called paranormal adrenaline. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of similar to adrenaline in that, you know,
One's paranormal.
Yeah. But it's like paranormal phenomenon are evoked or used only when needed. So, you know, it kind of makes them to some extent out of our conscious control. So you have this idea where a mother, you know, you've heard the stories of adrenaline where a child's trapped under a car and the mother gets this superhuman strength and just rips the car off the child.
Right.
She can't do that normally. There's some ideas that this is sort of how paranormal phenomenon work. You know, that there's an example that this Oxford-trained astrophysicist Michael Shalis gives, that there was a woman who lost her dog. She was in crisis mode. She couldn't find it, so she used dowsing. Put, you know, dowsing where you have the technique where you, to locate groundwater, oil, buried treasure. Sometimes you put a pendulum over a map and it'll swing in the location that you're looking for. Turns out it worked. She found the dog. But so they, when she did that, they said, well, this woman's psychic. We got to put her in a lab and test her. She couldn't do it again.
Right.
So why couldn't she do it again?
I would guess.
She was never in that. Yeah, go ahead.
I would guess one of two things occurred. She was so out of her own mind, and I don't mean psychologically, like she was mental, but she was in that moment, stretching beyond what she would normally do. And because she was open at that moment and had a focus that that intense, she was allowing the message to come through. I think a lot of people that rely on things like tarot cards and Ouija boards, bones, tea leaves, I think, and I've had many of them admit to me that they use it more as a tool to give them the ability to say what they believe is going on. And they can kind of, well, if you get the positive, yes, then that's what the cards are telling me. If you get the negative, well, you know, I might be misinterpreting the cards. Sometimes they do have multiple meanings, you know. But I wonder in that case if she was, the pendulum had nothing to do with it. She was focused and her intent was focused so strongly that she found the dog because she allowed that moment of connection to occur.
Yeah. And I would go a little bit further and say it has to do maybe with being in psychological distress. She was in crisis mode.
Right.
You know, and when we're in crisis mode, sometimes we use skills that we don't even know we have. It just sort of clicks in there. So when she was in psychological distress, crisis mode, her paranormal powers kicked in, sort of, if you want to say it like that. Now, when she wasn't like that, then she didn't have these sort of talents, if you want to call them that. So I think, emotions, psychological distress, crises, I really think that they're a lot of times the catalyst to a lot of the, you know, the spontaneous case examples, I really think that that's a starting point to it. And that's, emotions have always been linked with paranormal phenomenon. You know, that's nothing new, but, you know.
Well, and in moments of crisis, our brain is reacting and secreting. We know that in moments of like when we're working out or when we're happy, our brain secretes, chemicals that mm-hmm. can sustain those feelings. And you wonder if in these moments of crisis, is whatever chemical there activating the pineal gland, which may or may not be that third eye attunement that people claim it is. And mm-hmm. in these crisis moments, is that WD-40ing up that nozzle so that it can open up for a little bit and give us what we need?
Yeah. I mean, the pineal gland is that's one of the theories that are out there. I would say that, when we have overwhelming emotions, what that does is, emotions, psychological, if you're in a state where you're in a life-threatening event, you're in a plane and it's going down,
mm-hmm.
you're going to have a grab load of emotions. You're going to be overwhelmed. I don't want to die. This is it. Blah, blah, blah. It's going to keep going. You're going to be in quite an acute crisis state. I think, when we have those types of things, it affects us not only mentally, but physically. You know, it makes changes inside our bodies as well. We're all electrical beings, so these intense emotions cause distress or erratic fluctuations in our bioenergetics. And when we do that, that sort of changes our electrical magnetic field. And then, it kind of radiates into the environment. And then once that message is in the environment, it can sort of resonate or, be linked with someone who's sort of close to us.
Well, let's talk about that when we return. The resonance, the scarring, if you will, of a location after a very deeply traumatic or psychological event has happened. If this exists and there is energy, why are we not able to precisely divine a tool that can tune into that energy to read it and understand it, or perhaps even focus that energy? We'll talk to our guest when we return. His book, The Ghost Studies, New Perspectives on the Origins of Paranormal Experiences. Brendan Masullo are right here. on Beyond the Darkness.
Beyond the Darkness.
Hello, welcome back to the best in paranormal talk radio. Hey, listen, guys, there's a huge announcement. If you've missed it already, you've got to join this. This is a great opportunity to see Tim and I together, and you get a chance to go on a four-day cruise. And it's over Halloween of 2018. What? Yes, we're doing the Chris Jericho Rock and Wrestling Cruise. It is going to be phenomenal. Chris Jericho, along with many of his WWE friends and classic and iconic characters, will be on board. There will be rock bands. Comedian Jim Brewer is going to be on board. Yours truly and Tim will be there. We're going to be presenting a few different talks on the paranormal and hopefully scaring the hell out of you. So I hope you'll join us on this. You can get information at our website at darknessevents.com. Tickets are going to go fast. This is going to be an amazing adventure, and we'd love for you to join us. Besides, you get a chance to come on out and meet my bride. You'll get the chance to see all of the great people that'll be on board. And our Tim and my goal for the entire event is to eventually freak out a bunch of grown men that are much more powerful than we are with ghost stories. So that's well worth just showing up for right there. You can find more information again at darknessevents.com, and you'll see all the locations that we're going to be visiting throughout the next year, including my trip to Australia, which will be coming up next year as well. We're back and we're here with our guest this evening as we discuss his new book, The Ghost Studies, New Perspectives on the Origins of Paranormal Experiences. Brandon Masullo, our guest. Before the break, I kind of threw out the question to you that if this is going on and there is an energetic transference, we're marking a territory. Shouldn't we be able to, A, measure the electricity, the wavelength, the recordability of somebody in a crisis situation anyway, and then be able to tap into that and play it back like a tape recorder if we're able to figure out that frequency? And I would say we can figure out the frequency of Uranus, the planet, right, from here. Why can't we figure out somebody in a crisis situation's frequency to figure out when they're transmitting or receiving in these moments?
You know, when you do research, one of the things you have to do is you have to get all this ethical stuff really approved. So it's really hard to research somebody in an acute crisis. You know, when I worked in the emergency rooms, you were really providing treatment. You weren't asking them questions or having them fill out surveys or putting electrodes on them or doing things like that. So actually poking and prodding and doing that type of thing to people who are in emotional crisis can sometimes be more detrimental. So you're probably not going to, there's not a lot of research really on people who are in acute crisis.
But again, that is science's fault, because I can guarantee you there are enough of us believers out there that want answers. You know, when my mom passed away this past November, if there would have been a way to hook her up, measure her, weigh her electronically, get a feedback loop to try to find, my mom would have been the first to say, hook me up, let's see what happens. Yeah. And there are enough people that would go into it willingly and knowingly to, you know, wire me up so that when that moment happens, how does my brain react? What energy am I sending out or receiving? And, you know, and does it ever correlate and come to sync with the person whose body, you know, has just expired? I would think there's enough of us out there that type of study would be simple and enough people more than willing to be active participants.
You're probably right. It's just finding someone to follow through with that. And
all right, I'm giving that task to you, Brandon. Get to it.
I don't have the equipment nor the funding to do something like that. I could probably draw up a hypothesis or two and give you some sort of structure or outline to it. But, you know, when I did my research in Scotland, and it was I think we had 250 participants who were just walking through a haunted house. And it was like I had to submit a 15-page ethical paper basically saying how this wasn't going to affect these people long term. You know, so it was.
Oh, stop it. You can't make an omelet without breaking a few eggs, damn it. Sometimes you got to shake up the bowl to see what happens.
Well, yeah. And I had one question on my survey that said, have you ever had a traumatic experience? And they didn't want that on there. So that got kicked out of my survey. Because the idea was if you ask that and it brings up past trauma, then someone has to be there to counsel them and bring them down.
Oh, my God.
So, you know, there's a lot to that, and there's a lot of hurdles you jump through when you do research. So, you know, we see the end results, but sometimes you don't see the beginning results of this, which is these researchers in academia have to go through a lot of hoops just to get just to deal with participants.
All right. Well, let's talk about well-known haunted locations. The Queen Mary, the Stanley Hotel, Waverly Hills Sanitarium, Rolling Hills Asylum, Eastern State Penitentiary, Mansfield Reformatory. Those are just a few off the top of my head. The Palmer House Hotel here in Sauk Center, Minnesota, voted the number one most haunted hotel in the world 2 years ago through USA Today. Listen, if there's this many people having that much activity, shouldn't we be able to do a study that brings in equipment that can read? I mean, we can read and using like geophones pick up on tremors that took place, you know, 2,000 miles away from here. Mm-hmm. I've got to guess if there is some kind of psychological or energetic scarring of a location, that should be that should show up on some spectrum that we can tune in and out of. And again, I know a lot of this is theory and hypothesis, you've got more in this, but I mean, that's what you spent a lot of your time in your book doing, is opening up to discussions like this.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Do you think that we do have tools that we could use to tune in, or we're just not I guess that's just not important enough in the cosmic scheme of it. It's more about the personal experience as opposed to the scientific ramifications or theoretic principles of what's causing these moments.
Yeah. It's really tough because, you know, in order to measure something, you have to know kind of what it is you're trying to measure. And mm-hmm. I think that's the hard part. You know, first we have to figure out exactly what it is we're trying to measure. At this point, it seems to be somewhat EMF related when it comes to paranormal experiences or energetic. But measuring energy is not an exact science either. You know, it's a challenging endeavor. And at this point, you know, first, I guess the first part would be to get some sort of consistent, so we can consistently sort of get apparitional experiences. And then once you can do that on a fairly consistent basis, then the next step would be sort of measuring it. But I think that there's the technology is probably there, but we have to refine what we're looking for, what we're trying to measure. And that's the hard part. You know, I don't know necessarily if things are burned into the environment. I think that it has a lot to do with this telepathic distress signal that's kind of lingering out there. And that might be something that's,
but that is in essence a scarring.
Yeah.
Right. Because you're leaving the transponder open, you know, mm-hmm. Civil War sites where the people are still seen running through the fields. There's, you know, cannon fodder still heard and recorded. So there, mm-hmm. there has to be some kind of scarring that's taken. And scarring is just the most efficient word for me to use at this point. I can't think of another term that would kind of.
That's a good one.
Grab what I'm hoping for, but it does seem repeatable in a lot of senses. I guess I'm always astounded, as many of our listeners are, why this isn't taken more seriously and why we can't, mm-hmm. you know, have science step up and go, okay, fine, let's do this. We spend money, you know, they've spent millions of dollars finding out why spider monkeys masturbate when they're frightened. What good did that do any of us in the, you know, cosmic scheme of things? No good. We just have a weird fascination with masturbating spider monkeys. But I think it'd be much more appealing if science just said, all right, here, we're coming in $20 million. We've got a grant for 3 months or a year. We're going to sink into Gettysburg. We're going to take measurements. We're going to, you know, plant stakes. We're going to grid pattern these deals and see if we can pick up energetic signatures, you know, steps or things running through the field that are not there. It would seem that just in one serious place like Gettysburg, where it is known to happen consistently, we should be able to, one way or another, definitively decide this is happening or this is not happening.
Yeah. If you sink that amount of time, effort, and money into something, you probably will come up with an answer. I agree 100%. You get a lot of people who know what they're doing. You put them in a room. You give them money. And you come up with some sort of structure, hypothesis, testing.
Let me ask you the hard question then. Do you think that we have done this testing already? Do you think that they already have an idea and maybe the answer isn't what we want? And I mean in the sense of there is no heaven, there is no afterlife, like you said. You know, and I'm beginning to believe more and more that when we die, I don't know that our souls are hanging around here, disincarnate, you know, souls, that we may be dealing more with these scarred aftermaths. Yeah. These energetic signatures that are left replaying over and over in a loop. Mm-hmm. Do you think that maybe part of the reason that science doesn't go further is because the heartbreak and the panic people will truly go through once they realize that there is nothing after this?
No, I'll be straight with you. I just think that, a lot of people in academia don't think it's worth maybe researching, you know. They think they're hallucinations, misinterpretations, overactive imaginations, fraud.
But hasn't most things in science been looked at and snickered at one point or another? Yeah, yeah. Pasteurization, sure.
Yeah.
Radiation to kill cancer, you got it, right? I mean, it's all been scoffed at. Name one scientific principle that wasn't mocked at some point.
I agree 100%. It's there, and I wish they would really do it. But there's always obstacles when it comes to research in academia. I mean, the president of the American Statistical Association, which is the largest community of statisticians.
Nerds. I'm sorry, what?
Yeah. but her name is Dr. Jessica Utz. And, you don't get to be the president of the Association of Statistical Associations by not contributing to the field of academia.
Or you pay the $15 fee to get in. I don't know. It could be one or the other. I don't know. There's a bunch of people vying for that role either, Brandon.
It's an international community of all these professors who just do statistics. And, you know, in her presidential speech, I listened to a talk by Dr. Ed May, who was the lead researcher on the Stargate, which went from 72 to 95. That was the government's.
In Stargate, are we referring to the remote viewing Stargate program?
Yeah.
Okay.
Dr. May was the one who was running that thing. And Jessica Utz did sort of an independent review. And in her presidential speech, this is where the whole room was filled with people in tuxedos. She said, evidence for psi is quite strong statistically and would be widely accepted if it were related to something mundane. And she went on to say that most scientists reject its possibility without ever looking at the data. So it's some powerful words from someone who's sort of high up in this statistics.
Wow. Say that again for me. That's I want our listeners to really. I know you were just flipping through Facebook on your phone, and maybe you took a bite of a sandwich, and you didn't hear it through your own chewing. That was a really powerful statement. Can you repeat that?
Evidence for psi is quite strong statistically, and would be widely accepted if it related to something mundane. Most scientists reject its possibility without ever looking at the data. And there's a whole YouTube speech her speech is on YouTube that you could look up and listen to the whole thing. To me, that's more powerful than any sort of research I can point to. This is a person who's only does statistics. And if science really says, well, statistics and data is what we're looking for, and then you give them statistics and data and they say that's not enough, then there's a flaw somewhere in my eyes.
I couldn't agree more, right? Especially when you have somebody whose job it is to know the stats, and they're mm-hmm. telling you, this is just being ignored. That's ridiculous. I mean, it's a crime. It really is that part of science will just be rejected. You wonder at what point will we be enlightened enough? How long did it take for people to realize we weren't the center of the universe? Right. And that gravity was, we were under the command of gravity. It was not under our command. And, you know, it just seems ridiculous. Now, in the book, do you also cover paranormal experiences and people's stories?
Yeah, yeah. Throughout the whole book, I give, maybe 15, 20 ghostly encounters. And after every ghostly encounter, what's great about the book is I take it – there's a lot of great books out there that will tell you a good ghostly encounter, a good story, and then they kind of leave it at that.
Right.
After every ghostly encounter, I break it down and I tell you, you know, this is kind of what I believe is happening. This is what
All right.
I believe is occurring.
Well, let's do this. I know you just did recorded an episode for Jim Harold's Paranormal Podcast.
Yeah.
So I'm sure you kept the better stories for me. And let's if you could fish out a few stories maybe that you didn't just cover on another show, that'd be really great. I love Jim Harold, and all of our listeners know that. And if you haven't heard the Paranormal Podcast, shame on you. That's another great show you guys should go find and subscribe to immediately. And I love mentioning those kind of shows, too, because Jim and I can do an interview with the same guy and have two totally different interviews. And and have different perspectives on it. So make sure you check out Jim Harold's show. But give me a couple of your favorite or key examples in the books and then how you break it down even further, if you don't mind.
Yeah, sure. Let me pull one up here because I don't have them off the top of my head, unfortunately. I'm not that good. All right. So in the book, there's probably numerous ones in here. And I really kind of break it down as best as I can. They come from different areas, just from personal encounters. They also come from just some reading that I've done. But here's one that I picked up here. So I'll just read you what it says here. But
please.
John was sitting in his living room waiting for his wife, Emily, to come home from a girls' night out with some of her friends. And this is John's words. I had gotten a text message from Emily stating that they were leaving the restaurant and would be home in 20 minutes. An hour and a half had gone by with no word from Emily. I began to get extremely worried. However, I tried to remain calm. In an effort to distract myself, I went to my office and began to surf the internet. After a few minutes, I was absorbed in setting up my lineup for my fantasy football team, which played the next day. Suddenly, I got chills throughout my body to the point where I noticed goosebumps. My heart was pounding, and I felt another presence was in the room. Filled with fear, I noticed on my right-hand side slightly behind me a figure. I was too scared to turn my head, fearing that I was not prepared for what I would see. Summoning up the courage, I turned my head ever so slowly. I noticed a cloudy and transparent version of my wife. She was wearing the same clothes that she had left the house in earlier. However, they appeared disheveled and dirty. Her expression was flat, her eyes were shut, she had blood running down her head, and her right arm appeared distorted. I rose from my chair and screamed, "Emily!" At that moment, the apparition disappeared.
Wow.
So it turns out that Emily was not dead. She had an accident that occurred at the same time as the appearance of the apparition. She got into a car accident, had some head trauma, and a broken right arm. So that kind of correlates with what he was saying. Her head was bleeding, her right arm was distorted. So if you look at this closely, it's obvious that there was a visual image of an apparition. You know, Emily wasn't dead, so it wasn't a ghost, but rather she was seriously injured. So this has very many similarities to other reports of apparitions: sense of a presence, visual image, the image being transparent or smoke-like, and the image vanishing without a cause. So in this state, you know, what's also similar to a lot of ghost stories is, you know, John was in a relaxed or absorbed state, you know, surfing the internet, similar to meditating or, you know, laying down. If he was in a crowded, nightclub, do you think he would have gotten this type of message? Probably not. So here we have Emily had a trauma or an unexpected life-threatening injury. You know, it kind of set in motion this whole apparitional experience. So like we talked about before, emotion is sort of the beginning of the process, and it's sort of the metaphorical switch that turns on the machine. You know, radios and cell phones don't work unless there's power to them. So emotion turns or initiates this process. So it causes – now when you have emotion, that causes these intense bioelectrical polarity shifts inside our bodies. And when that happens, it's sort of, in other words, our emotions trigger or send electrical message throughout our bodies, affects our electrical fields, and this transmission information kind of goes out into the environment. So it's sort of coming through our own electrical fields and sort of permeating out into the environment. Once something's in the environment, it can go all over the place.
You know, your radio,
you can pick up your cell phone and call someone in, you know, Japan, and it happens in a heartbeat. So this idea that, that we can communicate at great distances is not science fiction. It's happening every day. So once something's in the environment, it's out there. So this is what you have. You have the catalyst sets it in motion, which is the trauma, energy shifts. Then you have this changes inside us that gets linked to the outside. Once it's outside, this telepathic distress signal is sort of out there, and it just sort of resonates, and it just attracts to someone who we're emotionally linked to. So with that, that's sort of the basis of the ghostly ingredients theory that I have. You have, if you want to look at it as an equation, psychological aspects, which is the emotions, plus bioenergetic fluctuations, which happens inside us, plus external information acquisition, which is sort of that our stuff going out into the world and then getting entangled or resonating with somebody else or synchronizing with somebody else. And then once that happens, then you get these sort of paranormal or ghost-like things occurring. So that's it in a nutshell. And it has, you know, there's a lot that kind of goes into it, but a condensed version is kind of what the ghostly ingredients theory is.
This is fascinating. I can't even begin to wrap my mind around how exciting talking about these type of subjects is, and just kind of getting the juices in the brain rolling again. I understand the idea of these crisis moments, Brandon, mm-hmm. and that we have that connection. So it could be a telepathic message that we're picking up on. It could be an energetic message that we're picking up on, whatever we want to discern it as. But what about these experiences when we run into ghosts we have no attachment to? We don't know who they are. We weren't expecting to see them there, but yet there they were. And they seem to interact with us. We weren't just watching through a paranormal TV screen at something unfolding in front of us. This ghost noticed us and we noticed it.
Yep. And you're exactly right. So
Can you say that again? Not many people ever say that to me.
You're sort of right. How's
okay.
That?
There we go.
So what I talk about the ghostly ingredients theory doesn't account for hauntings or residential type experiences. And that's evident. So what I have is I take that a little step further, and I have what I call it sort of plays on the ghostly ingredients, but it's called the spontaneous apparitional trace theory. So I'll give you another case example that I think is really good, because you mentioned Gettysburg and the Civil War before. So I'll give you the one I have about that. And what I like about this is this case example is it's sort of a mixture of a lot of things from a different places, but I think it's a good way to start if you want to look at what exactly a haunting is or a residential apparition is. So if we have time, I'll go over a quick case example and then I'll explain hauntings.
Yes, please. The floor is yours.
Okay. So in 1863, Deborah had a 19-year-old son who was fighting in the Battle of Gettysburg. He was there on the battlefield. According to Deborah, in more or less words, "I woke up one morning around 2 a.m. feeling like I had been punched in the head. I was covered in sweat, had a terrible headache, and felt blood gushing down my face. I couldn't breathe, and I was gasping for air, as if choking. I felt my lungs were filling with water or sludge, so I went to the bathroom to try and cough up the substance. I was overwhelmed with feelings of fear, sadness, and anger. Feeling weak, I sat down on the bathroom floor while crying. At that moment, I saw an image of my son, in full uniform and covered in blood. I then heard my son's voice saying, 'Tell mom I love her. Please tell her I love her.' The image and my physical symptoms vanished within seconds. Picking myself off the floor, I looked in the mirror and saw no blood or bump that would indicate I hurt my head. A week later, Deborah learned via telegraph that her son's death, which occurred at the same time as her strange symptoms that occurred that evening. According to reports, he died from a gunshot to the chest and severe head trauma." Right. So in this example, gunshot to the chest, that might lead to someone gasping for air as if choking, or feeling like your lungs are filled with water or sludge, and then severe head trauma that might indicate because she had some blood rushing down her face and her head hurt. Right. So in this example, this is a good example of that spontaneous case example, right? So this happened to Deborah in 1863. She experienced overwhelming sadness, fear, anger, apparitions of her son in the uniform, hearing her voice, his son say, "Tell my mom I love her," felt blood gushing down her head, which is tactile phenomenon, which happens a lot in ghostly encounters. People feel like they got their hair touched or someone pushed them, feeling like their lungs were filled with water. These are all sort of the ghostly phenomenon that she experienced. All right. So let's take that example and let's skip ahead 150 years. All right. So me and you, Dave, were part of a paranormal investigation team, right? And we're out in Gettysburg. Have you ever been to Gettysburg?
Yes, numerous times.
Numerous times. So me and you are in Gettysburg.
Mm-hmm.
And let's say while we're on Gettysburg, you reach the site where this Deborah's son got killed 100 years ago. And as you're on this site, you start having these unexplained headaches, much like Deborah did. You start having trouble breathing. This all common stuff that happens to people who have these experiences. You get overwhelming sadness, fear, anger. You smell blood. You feel like stuff's dripping down your head. You heard or you've collected EVPs of a man's voice saying, "Tell my mom I love her." And you see an apparition of a Civil War soldier covered in blood. All right. So this is 150 years in the future, and you're having the same symptoms that this Civil War soldier's mother had in 1863. All right.
That means I'm obviously the reincarnation of his mother, and I'm living it all over again, Brandon.
What happened is he sent this telepathic distress signal 150 years ago, right? So maybe the haunting is not so much an imprint that's burned into it or a ghost, but you're picking up on this telepathic distress signal that's sort of lingering around. So it's not the event, the tragedy, anything like that. It's the telepathic message that people are picking up on 150 years in the future. And what makes this interesting is that with this sort of theory, the spontaneous apparitional trace theory is, it doesn't have to sort of be linked to one place, right? So you get these feelings on the Civil War battleground. Let's say a week later, we're investigating the Deborah's house, you know, the mom, and we start feeling this overwhelming sadness, filled blood, hear EVPs of "Tell my mom I love her," that type of thing. So not only could you pick up maybe information on the battleground of this distress signal, but you could also pick up this information at the end point, which is Deborah's house or the son's house. So this sort of accounts for why you might have hauntings in places where people maybe never died. You might have hauntings in places that are houses that are 2, 3, 4 years old. So unlike imprint or trace theory, I don't believe that the event, such as the violent death, is what causes an imprint into the electromagnetic tracings, but rather this message that the agent had sent during the traumatic event or violent death, which is sort of imprinted. And my theory also differs from imprint and place theory in that, like I said, the haunting doesn't have to coincide with the location or the origin of the tragic event, but it can occur at the destination or the end point of this telepathic message. So you might be getting the same signals or haunt-type phenomenon in Gettysburg as you are in Deborah's house in Idaho.
I've got I'll talk to you about this off air, since I've talked about this theory before with people regarding that imprint theory and idea and that message that still is there. And it might give you a little insight and something to track down as well for your follow-up books. But it remind me to talk to you about that afterwards. It's a fascinating aspect, I think, of the whole paranormal phenomena.
Yep.
Where do you stand in this whole thing? I mean, do you have to have drawn a few lines. Do you believe that our bodies die and that our soul self does live on, or does it snuff out like a candle in the wind?
I don't think it snuffs out in the candle in the wind. I I think consciousness.
Listen to the pain in your voice. Who am I going to piss off with this answer? Right? Isn't that exactly what you're going through right now?
You know, it's you have all these, you know, you lay in bed and you have all these thoughts about, you know, what happens after we die, right? And it seems like every week I have a different sort of thought on this whole subject.
Right, right.
As far as that, I don't think we're not like, you know, neuropsychology would say we're a computer or we're a robot, and that once we stop working, we cease to exist like a TV or a computer. That's just it. We're done. You know, and I don't necessarily think that's it. I think consciousness can sort of I think it can go places. Where it goes, I don't know. I mean, near-death experiences are a good example of sort of consciousness leaving the body. I don't believe in sort of this earthbound spirits or people staying around to fix problems like the Ghost Whisperer shows. I don't think people choose to stay. I'm not on that boat, but I do believe that there is something after we cease to exist, or else these sort of spontaneous, these crises, these deathbed apparitions, this wouldn't exist if we just ceased to exist.
And it may work this way too, right? I mean, this radio transmission being beamed out across the universe through radio frequency, this will continue to play out. And the theoretic idea is if there's somebody with a receiver that's tuned into the right place at the right time, they're going to capture this audio somewhere else. So if our consciousness truly transcends the physical form and goes on, it may not be an intelligent entity after it leaves, but it may be a collective memory. It may be a file folder, a file of facts of who we once were. And I often wonder if reincarnation and thoughts of reincarnation really have very little to do with a soul leaving one body and being born again into another, as opposed to Dave Schrader died in 1812, Brandon was born in 1966, and you just happen to be kind of resonating at that right tune, right at the right frequency. And as you're growing up, you're just continually picking up the radio program that was Dave Schrader's life. So you might believe that then this was tied to a past life for yourself, but it may in fact be nothing more than you being a really open radio transceiver for that story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, Persinger, he has a YouTube lecture. I think it's called No More Secrets or something like that. But in it, he kind of says, and he does all the calculations and all that, but he says that the Earth's magnetic field has sufficient capacity sort of to represent or store the information within the energy that's been associated with sort of the action potentials of every human being that ever existed on the planet. So in theory, what he says is we have access to information from every brain.
Right. The Akashic records.
Yeah. 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 And, you know, this idea that, you know, we kind of could at any point, if we had the ability to, tap into sort of Abraham Lincoln's thoughts or Albert Einstein or something like that.
Oh, I have, and they're filthy, filthy, filthy thoughts. Those men should be ashamed of themselves.
Yeah. But that's amazing. You know, like you said, it's just sort of floating around somewhere in the universe.
Well, even Thomas Edison and Tesla both believed that the spirit or the energy that we are contained within us should be a frequency that, if applied correctly, could be tuned into. Both of them went on record. I mean, it's part of Edison's original biography that he believes that, you know, that there should be a piece of equipment sensitive enough to tune into that at some point.
Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing how all these great thinkers and everyone has sort of similar thoughts, yet nothing really came of it, unfortunately.
Are you sure?
I'm not sure.
Maybe they're giving you this information right now, Brennan. You never know.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, maybe.
Have you had what you would perceive to be a true paranormal experience?
You know, yes and no. I've never witnessed, and you know, I'm jealous of people who witness sort of apparitions and have these amazing paranormal encounters where they come in contact with deceased loved ones and, you know, just amazing, powerful things that I've never had anything like that happen to me. You know, I had some things that I really couldn't explain.
Give me an, for example, something that even your mind couldn't explain. I didn't mean that to sound as condescending as I realized that just came out. Oh, come on, do tell, Brian. And what even couldn't your brain discern? No, but what's something that even you can't just brush away as a mistake?
I think about a year or two ago, I was, I have a routine, and we all have routines in the morning.
Right.
And one of my routines is, you know, I take my dog out. She goes to the bathroom. She comes back in. I feed her. I get ready for work. She lays on the bed. I take her out one more time. Then I go to work. About a year or so ago, she was acting really weird in the morning. She came up to me. She woke me up. She went outside and she's like a bloodhound or a hound dog. So she just sniffs, was really restless and irritated and was searching for something. She eventually came in and then, I went about my routine and I started getting these, sort of feelings, like I was anxious, I was restless, I was sort of, I don't know how to describe it, sort of like distressed, couldn't just unsettling feelings and impressions as if something wasn't right. So it's like adrenaline and decisiveness and fear. So I sort of said, well, maybe I'm having one of these telepathic sort of impressions or some sort of something's going on in the environment that I need to be aware of. And I thought, oh my God, who am I most emotionally linked to? Like, who would I, you know what I'm saying?
You're going through the emotional Rolodex.
Yeah. Okay. Who would be top on the list that my dog and me would be concerned if something happened to? Mm-hmm. It was my wife. And she was actually in California. So I'm in Ohio. So there's not much I can do. So what I did was I sort of embraced it rather than sort of push it down. I embraced it. I opened the back door. Me and the dog went outside because that's where she wanted to go. And she was sniffing. And then out of nowhere, I saw something floating in our pond. And I didn't know what it was. Turns out, and this is a sad story, I'm sorry, it was a neighborhood cat. So something pulled the dog outside and something pulled me outside. I don't know what it was, but...
Well, the dog could smell cat soup.
But what's weird is she never went that way.
Right.
She couldn't pick up on what was causing her distress. And, you know, the only way I noticed it was something out there. But, you know, I've been having this routine for, I don't know, 5, 10 years maybe. And I've never been pulled outside like that. And it made me kind of think, why would I be sort of attached to a cat? And then I thought to myself, you know what? I've seen this cat every day for the last, since I moved into the house 5 years ago. You know, the dog sees it every day. So there is some sort of connection there. It's not a strong one.
Well, the strong connection was between you and your dog. And if the dog had noticed it and it was bothering the dog, I think, again, it was beaming out and you were receiving.
That's a good possibility. I didn't think of it in that way. Yeah.
So okay. Just call me anytime, Brennan. I'll help you figure these things out.
Yeah. It's kind of a bizarre sort of, you know, I couldn't explain it. Like, why of all the days for me to have this sort of rush and the dog to be acting weird, was it the day that this poor cat was in there? And it happened probably within minutes because, you know, I mean, you can tell if something's been in there for a week or something like that. But it was a really sad story. But, you know, at that point, I kind of was like, you know what, this is kind of an experience.
No, definitely. Yeah, that's I'll tell you what. This is what I'd like to do. I'm friends with the comedian and actor Jay Mohr. And
oh, sure.
He is a fascinating man with an amazing electric brain. And I'm doing my best to get him out here to Minnesota to go to the Palmer House Hotel to investigate with me.
Oh, boy.
I would like to if we can set this up, I would like for you to join us over a 3-day weekend. And we'll whoop it up as boys do, but investigate, because I will tell you, if you're looking to have that first real experience,
yeah,
I don't mean with two other men, I mean paranormal experience, Brandon, I got to draw the line somewhere. I'll say this, I would love to have your two brains together in the same place. I think, first of all, we need to record it, and there's going to be a book coming out of it. Second of all, I have seen things that defy any sort of logic. And some days, listen, in any field that you work in, at some point you get disillusioned and you start to wonder why. Why am I doing this?
Yep.
And thank God for the Palmer House, because, you know, it's like the mob. Every time I'm getting out, it drags me back in again. And I realize that there's something. I've seen things and have been in rooms where multiple people have witnessed the same thing. And you cannot deny what's going on at this place. So Why don't you?
I would love that. Sounds amazing to me.
We'll keep in touch. We'll make this happen. And Jay, I know, loves good brains and big brains. And I'll connect you too. You got to get your book out to him so he can interview you as well on his podcast, on Podcast One. But this has been a fascinating discussion. I really enjoy chatting with you about this.
Me too.
And being a part of the show with us. If people are interested in more of your work and research, is there a website they can go to?
Yeah, I have a website. It's I'm on Facebook and Twitter too, but the website is hauntedtheories.com, and the Twitter is @hauntedtheories, and Facebook is @hauntedtheories as well. The website goes over – I have a blog on the website where I go over some of the latest research and just some thoughts on paranormal stuff. If you ever wanted to check out my research, you can just type in environmental sensitivity and paranormal experiences. It's free. It goes over kind of what I did in Edinburgh and kind of gives a nice background to some of my thoughts on environmental sensitivity and things like that.
See, now I have to question that you were ever there, because anybody that's been there knows it's Edinburgh. We've been yelled at by enough Scottish listeners. It's not Edinburgh. It's Edinburgh. What's wrong with you?
Yeah, well, I just call it Edinburgh.
Yeah, exactly. Edinburgh. Up there in Edinburgh, Scotland. The Ghost Studies, Brandon Masullo, thank you so much for being a part of our show.
Well, thank you, Dave. It's been great.
That's it for tonight, folks. We'll be back again tomorrow with more of the best in paranormal talk radio. I'm Dave Schrader, and this is Beyond the Darkness.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.